From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The pursuit of diversity is causing major problems for American higher education. That's according to the Manhattan Institute scholar who wrote a book called The Diversity Delusion. She shared her concerns recently in Raleigh. North Carolina lawmakers have finalized new reforms to laws involving sexual assault and child sex abuse. You'll learn details. Three generations of the Scott family had major impacts on North Carolina politics. We'll chat with a longtime political columnist who tells their story in a recent book. And we'll learn why we should be concerned about a federal program called Equitable Sharing. It threatens your property rights through civil asset forfeiture. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina has implemented transformational reforms in the last decade that have created more opportunities for more people than ever before. The John Locke Foundation's Becky Gray, who is senior vice president, well, she's been at the table, in the trenches, at the forefront, advocating for Locke Foundation policy recommendations. In fact, she's been doing that for more than a decade. Interesting, she is going to be speaking on Monday here at the John Locke Foundation about the 2019 year, different victories for freedom, and how it all works and looks for 2020, particularly in this hyper-partisan political environment. In fact, Becky says that we sometimes forget fiscally sound public policies that promote free markets, limited government, and more are really the foundation of good government. Becky joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
All right. So 2019, a whole lot of things went on at the General Assembly. You were there blow by blow. But it's interesting that your recap of the year really shows that there has been a multi-year advancement of freedom and liberty, starting with respect for North Carolina taxpayers.
Exactly. And Donna, you know, when we look back, and if you take just 2019 to evaluate what the conservative policies went forward, what wasn't, it's only part of the story and part of these really transformational reforms, as you mentioned. You know, since 2011, we have drastically reduced taxes, made the tax system fair. We have reined in the growth of government, much more sensible. We've saved money rather than we not only have extra money, we've got money to put aside into savings. We've also rolled back regulations. We're making better, smarter investments in education that impact kids in the classroom, and then better investments in infrastructure across the state as well. 2019 continued a lot of those, but it was a very interesting year and different over the last decade because of the political makeup that we had this session. Of course, we have a Democrat governor, we have a Republican General Assembly, but they no longer hold the supermajority. So the governor's veto was much more powerful this last session in 2019 than it had been in the past. As a matter of fact, Roy Cooper has vetoed more bills than all previous governors combined. That gives you an idea of this, again, very controversial, very
it was pretty contentious for very, quite a long time.
It was very contentious. And the other thing, you know, in the introduction, you mentioned there was a lot that happened in 2019. There was a lot that happened, but there was really very little that got done because of this divide and Roy Cooper stopping so many things. You know, he vetoed the budget this year, and there's been a lot of talk about that. Let me just remind our listeners and remind all of us, Governor Cooper has vetoed every single budget that the Republicans have put into play since they have been in power. The difference this year was there was not a supermajority of Republicans. He held that Democratic caucus hostage through this whole session and, you know, really made them declare loyalty to him and the party over their constituents. So this is the first year in my memory that we have gone into the new calendar year without a budget in place.
You know, Becky, you mentioned the issue of sound fiscal policies, and despite the vetoes and the back and forth over the past few years, we definitely have seen the Republican-led General Assembly really rein in that spending growth and focus on savings. And sometimes people might think, well, savings, yeah, you can do that. That's kind of, you know, the icing on the cake. But boy, did we see that become really, really important when we had storms, hurricanes, and a lot of North Carolinians in need. That money was there, set aside to help.
Yeah, the money was there. And, you know, $2 billion, that's about 10% of our whole budget. It's the highest it's ever been in state history. And, you know, as a matter of fact, when the Republicans were doing this and taking some of that surplus money, may come as a surprise to some folks that the John Lott Foundation, rather than saying, let's take all of that money and give it back to the taxpayers, which is part of this, but we were really at the forefront of saying, you know what we need to do? What's really smart is to put money aside in a savings account. So, like you said, if we need it, it's there. And we think in terms of having that money set aside for, as you mentioned, a natural disaster, the hurricanes that have hit the eastern part of the state. We've had storms and flooding in the western part of the state. We had some money there to get people back up on their feet, to get businesses back and running, to get people back to normal. But the other reason why that's so important is when we have an economic downturn, and we don't know when it's coming, but we know that it is coming. North Carolina is really well positioned to weather that kind of storm. And this is probably going to happen. Things totally out of the control of North Carolina lawmakers. You know, this has maybe coming from a national perspective, international perspective, but it's still something we're going to have to deal with. And with this kind of savings aside, we have money to get people back up on their feet. At the very least, we can pay our bills, we can pay our teachers, we can pay our police officers, we can keep government going without going back to taxpayers who are struggling through economic downturn and asking them to send more money to the state. So reining in that growth of government to a really efficient, effective level and having that money set aside so we can meet our obligations when we may need to, I think is one of the smartest things and one of the smartest reforms that we've done. Talk about good policy. This, in my view, and all of this together has made North Carolina a national model, but I don't think that we talk enough about the significance of setting that money aside and how important it is to have that savings.
And while that was all going on, the savings, the reining in spending growth, really planning for the future, there was also a concerted multi-year effort to make sure that working North Carolinians were keeping more of what they earned through changes in tax policy. And that's happened for several years. Really important.
It's very important. And Donna, you know, I mean, it's something that just seems like a sense of fairness and transparency and openness and expectations for government. But the other thing is, it's a real different way of looking at things, that if people keep more of that their money, if businesses are able to keep more of that money, well, if people are able to keep more of that money, that means they can spend a little bit of extra over the holidays. They can invest in their homes. They can do home improvements. Businesses can buy a new computer. They can buy a new pickup truck, or they can hire a new person. And so that's the way, and we've seen this really illustrated over the last 10 years. This is the way that you grow an economy. This is the way that you get people back on their feet.
Now, Becky, on Monday, you're going to be talking at noon at the John Locke Foundation about some of these same issues, but also looking ahead to 2020. By the way, folks, if you can't make it to Raleigh to actually hear and see Becky in person, we'll be live on Facebook. You can check us out there. Becky, give us a quick sense of 2020. What are you expecting?
Well, we got two things going on here, Donna, that are related but separate. One is the preparation for the election. And, of course, we now know who is running for all of the offices in North Carolina. We're looking at those. A lot of conversation about which races are important, which are competitive, looking at national influences, you know, how is that going to affect the election in 2020? But don't forget, we also have another short session that's scheduled, that they're coming back in just about 10 days for the first phase of that. We may very well see the budget overridden during that time, but then we'll have the short session, and there's going to be some policies and some things that are discussed. And of course, we'll be keeping up with all of that at the Lott Foundation and through Carolina Journal. But, you know, we have another session to get through and some things of looking at continuing the momentum that we've done, really addressing some health care issues is something that hasn't been addressed as completely as we believe that it should be.
And so Becky Gray will be there at the legislature as it all takes shape. And of course, you can follow her on Twitter as well, at Becky Gray, and also at Carolina Journal and at John Locke NC. You can keep up to date on what is happening seeing what the policymakers are doing in your name and with your money. Becky Gray, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Race and gender pandering corrupt the university and undermine our culture. That's the stark assessment in the subtitle of a book with the full title, The Diversity Delusion, and its author joins us now. Heather McDonald is Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Mitch. I appreciate it.
So why tackle this topic, the impact of this goal of diversity and social justice on university campuses?
Because it's transforming our world for the worse, I believe. And because I believe very strongly in the value, the preciousness of our Western inheritance. And that is now under lethal assault on college campuses. Students are being taught not just to hate the great works of Western civilization, but to hate America, to hate each other, to see oppression where none exists. And so I wrote this book really out of sorrow and rage, sorrow that the things that I love and so many people should value are being subjected to a completely illegitimate attack, claiming that they works like Shakespeare or Milton or Mark Twain are somehow purveyors of lethal bigotry and sexism, a ridiculous idea, but also just anger that universities, which should be the place where students learn to get down there on their knees in gratitude before our civilization, are instead now more and more devoted to teaching students to think of themselves as victims and oppressed. A preposterous conceit, but they bring that delusion with them into the world at large, and they are transforming it very rapidly.
Someone out there is going to be listening and saying, it can't be that bad. This has to be hyperbole.
Yeah.
Is it really that bad?
No, it's really that bad. I travel, I speak at a lot of college campuses. Not only am I subjected to the hysterical student mob that feels that any challenge to their claim to be oppressed must come out of bigotry, But I ask students what their favorite courses are, what their majors are, and it's a very depressing roster. Nobody's studying the humanities anymore, and if they are, it's the most shallow of courses, you know, comic books, Cuban comic books or Hispanic comic books or media studies. A school has to work very hard to avoid the penetration of the diversity ideology into its core curriculum, into its faculty. Right now, the left has the bit on its teeth and is spreading this idea that the West in general and America in particular are the sources of all of the world's oppression throughout English courses, throughout anthropology, throughout social sciences, throughout sociology, throughout political science. If you don't think it's bad, it means you're not paying attention. And I wish I had that naivete and innocence left. But I can tell you every single day, if you're following these things, every single day brings news of a new enormity that is happening somewhere to our traditions, to our culture, to the things that, again, are should be precious to all of us.
We are chatting with Heather McDonald, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of the book that describes the situation titled The Diversity Delusion. Colleges have always been liberal, left of center. When did it start to happen that we got this situation where the basic tenets of Western civilization and America itself get attacked?
I think it began in the 1980s. That's when you had the rise of multiculturalism and of identity politics. I'm very grateful that I was in college in the 1970s. And although I got sucked into a very nonsensical and counterfactual set of ideas in literary theory known as deconstruction, which I'm not going to get into because it's just too bizarre. Nobody would believe it if I described it. But at least in the 1970s, we still read the great books without anybody thinking to gripe that they were written by white males. So I got to lose myself in the beauty of Chaucer, Edmund Spenser, John Milton, Alexander Pope, William Wordsworth. I wrote my senior thesis on Wordsworth. It never occurred to me to think that, well, I'm not reading female writers, so, you know, my identity is not being mirrored back to me. No, I read the greatest works of literature. Being female is not an accomplishment. It is not particularly interesting. But what happened in the 1980s, for a variety of reasons that are complex and somewhat mysterious, you had the rise of identity politics. Most infamously, the protests led by Jesse Jackson at Stanford University against Stanford's very modest, undemanding freshman core curriculum that made some minimal effort to expose students systematically to the dramatic sweep of Western civilization. But it read the classics. And sorry, folks, get over it. The greatest thinkers in Western civilization, with exceptions, of course, have been white males. Who cares? But this was the start of the period where females and minority students claimed that to read white males was oppressive to their identity. So Jesse Jackson led the famous chant, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go." This was a play on words because Western Civ was the shorthand for this course. But frankly, it was quite, it adumbrated what was coming because, in fact, that mentality that sees oppression in beauty and greatness would spread, and indeed all of Western civilization would come under attack.
You mentioned naivete about this situation. Mm-hmm. For folks who get beyond that stage because they read The Diversity Delusion, yes, or start to pay attention, what do you hope happens next?
Well, I certainly hope that alumni stop giving money to their alma maters. I can guarantee you, unless you've done a heck of a lot of due diligence and you are confident that your English department is not filled with theory-based courses on post-colonialism and intersectional gender studies and white privilege, if you have not confirmed for a fact that it is not doing those things, the chances are very high that it is. And the school that you remember does not exist any longer, unless you're very young, in which case you may be a product of the diversity-obsessed academy. But do not give money to your school unless you know that it is still committed unapologetically and joyfully to passing on our inheritance. What I would hope is that parents, actually, at this point, I think we're going to have to start homeschooling in college. And I'm somebody who aspired to be an academic. I wanted to go to school all my life. I aspired to teach in comparative literature. I think there is no greater good, no higher life than being an academic and curating these works. At this point, though, I think we're going to need a homeschooling movement for college because it is such a grotesque waste of money. You have these metastasizing diversity bureaucracies, a consumer culture where very little is being asked of students, and they are not being exposed systematically to the great works. I wasn't either in the 70s. Parents should know that if they want their kids to be rigorously exposed, they need to have very hands-on, or again, I think we're going to have some alternative institutions being created.
Well, if you want to learn much more about this topic, you can consult the book. It is titled The Diversity Delusion. Its author has been our guest, Heather McDonald. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A unanimous North Carolina General Assembly has approved reforms dealing with sexual assault and child sexual abuse. Among the changes, lawmakers closed loopholes linked to old court precedents. North Carolina will no longer be the only state in which a person cannot revoke consent to a sex act. The reform also clarifies the law involving sex with someone incapacitated by drugs or alcohol. Republican State Representative Dennis Rydell helped hammer out the compromise measure. It addresses one of his key issues, extending the time period for a victim of child sex abuse to file suit against a predator.
This brings North Carolina law into really the 21st century in the areas of child abuse, sexual assault, and particularly the ugly crime of child sexual abuse. I have received dozens upon dozens upon dozens of emails, letters, text messages, phone calls from victims who have been following the progress of our bill dealing with particularly child sexual abuse. And to those victims, I want to say this bill is for you. If you are a victim of child abuse, this bill is for you. If you're an adult victim of sexual assault, this bill is for you. If you're a victim of child sexual abuse and you had your childhood innocence ripped out of your soul by an adult predator, this bill is for you.
In the Senate, Democrat Jay Chaudhry explained his support for the package of reforms.
I stand here to support this bill really as a father of two children because I believe there is nothing more important than protecting our children from harm. Too often we know stories or read stories about child abuse crimes, and in many instances we discover these crimes go unreported for years. I will highlight just two parts of the bill that I believe are very important. First, this legislation, I believe, sends a loud and clear message to any adult in any institution who suspects child abuse taking place. And if you, it essentially says if you don't report such abuse, there will be consequences, and this legislation puts an end to that cover-up. And second, this legislation reworks a statute that protects children online from high-risk sex offenders, and I believe it does so consistent with the United States Supreme Court decision as well.
Among the other items addressed in the reforms, school personnel will get training about child sex abuse and sex trafficking. High-risk sex offenders will be banned from online conduct that threatens children. Attempting to drug someone's food or drink will face new sanctions. It expands the duty of anyone over 18 to report knowledge of a sex crime against a juvenile. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Three generations of the Scott family played important roles in North Carolina state government. Longtime News and Observer political columnist Rob Christensen tells their story in the book The Rise and Fall of the Branchhead Boys. He recently shared highlights from the book for the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society and joins us now to discuss key ideas from that presentation. Welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Glad to be here, Mitch.
So first of all, before we get into the Scott family, let's talk about that title. Who were the Branchhead Boys?
So Carr Scott, who was elected governor in 1948, was an insurgent candidate. The Democratic machine had been running things, and they would name governors, who's going to be governor in 4 years and 8 years and 12 years and so forth. And so Carr Scott ran against the machine, which meant that when he went into a county to campaign, he really couldn't get many votes out of the courthouse crowd. He couldn't get from the judges and the clerks of courts and the sheriff, and who were essentially the Democratic establishment in each county. So what he would do is he would hit the most rural areas, the head of the creeks, or as he said, at the head of the branches. And so by the time he got to the courthouse, it didn't matter that the lawyers and the judges and the sheriff weren't supporting him because he had all the support he needed in that county from the rural people. And he called them Branchhead Boys because they were the people who lived at the head of the branch or the head of the creek.
And your book talks about the Scott family and also, as the title suggests, a rise and a fall of the Branchhead Boys. We're going to get into their rise and fall, but let's turn back now to the Scotts. You mentioned Carr Scott, the patriarch of the family. This family ended up having an important role in North Carolina politics for several generations.
It did. So, you know, there's a lot of states that have a family that's more important than others. So you think about the Byrds of Virginia, the Talmadges of Georgia, the Longs of Louisiana, the Bushes of Texas, so forth, Kennedys of Massachusetts. And that family is the Scott family in North Carolina. And it's several generations. So Carr Scott's daddy, Robert Scott, everyone called him Farmer Bob, was influential legislator in helping create NC State and so forth. Carr Scott was himself elected agriculture commissioner 36 and governor 48 and United States Senate 54. His brother Ralph Scott was one of the more influential legislators of the 20th century. His son Bob Scott was elected lieutenant governor 64 and governor 68 and head of the community college system. His daughter-in-law, Jessie Ray Scott, ran for labor commissioner. And his granddaughter, Meg Scott Phipps, was elected agriculture commissioner, which is in 2000, which is a whole other story.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in just a bit, which ties into the fall. Why do you think it was that this particular family ended up becoming so influential?
So it's really hard to imagine in today's age of selfies and sushi and Starbucks, what North Carolina life was like back in mid-20th century, particularly in the 30s, 1940s, and even into the 1950s. This was overwhelmingly a rural state, rural and small town. Two-thirds of the people lived in what the Census Bureau said was defined as rural areas. And while life was pretty good in the towns and cities where you had all the modern amenities, that was not the case in rural North Carolina. So it was one among the last places in the country to get their roads paved, to get power, electric power, and run out to the farms, to get telephone service out in the farms. And one of the things I talk about in this book is the difficulty of life that we forget how remote and difficult rural life was without all these modern amenities. It was not only just inconvenience, it was often a matter of life and death, whether you could get to the doctor or get to the hospital in time and that sort of thing. And so the Scotts, they lived in a fairly modest farmhouse in the middle of the state. He was a dairy farmer all his life, really never left Alamance County. Even when he was governor, he would go back every weekend to the farm. When he was a senator, he would come back quite often. So he farmed that in his entire life. So it was a very modest family, but he was able to plug into a real need. He didn't have to do a poll or a focus group to find out what rural people in North Carolina needed. They needed some progress. They were their lives. We talk today about how different the lives are between urban and rural people, but it was even the contrast was even more stark back then. And he understood the needs, and the voters were willing to elect him.
We're chatting with Rob Christensen, the author of The Rise and Fall of the Branchhead Boys, a story of the Scott family and its influence on North Carolina politics. You have alluded to this already, but basically it sounds like this message was a combination of populism, but also what we would describe today as progressivism,
yes,
bringing those two things together. It seems as if that ended up being very appealing to several generations of North Carolinians.
It did. But that changed. So one of the things I did is I spent months and months going through the letters of Governor Carr Scott, who's like 1948, and the letters of his son, Bob Scott, when he was elected governor in 1968. And the tenor of the letters between the father and the son, 20-year difference, was just startling. The tenor of the letters for the Governor Carr Scott, like 1948, were, we want an activist government to help improve the lives of rural people, whether it's more roads or pressuring the power companies or building schools. By 1968, when Bob Scott, his son, was elected governor, is a 180-degree turn. It's the message was from letter after letter, was we want the government out of our affairs, the government off our back. Now, what happened in between those 20 years? Well, several things happened. Among other things, school integration happened. It was occurring when Bob Scott was elected governor, integration in a major way. And that was a very difficult time for a lot of people of both races. There was the campus unrest, which caused a lot of people to become much more conservative. Here's an anecdote that startled me, that in the year 1969, which was the first year that Governor Bob Scott was governor, he called out the National Guard for civil unrest 9 times in the first 6 weeks. Now, Mitch, You know, I've been around this town for a while. When was the last time a governor called out the National Guard for civil unrest? He called out 9 times in 6 months. Plus, there were other factors going on. So, you know, the farming had changed. So, you know, when Carscott was elected, there were roughly 300,000 farms in North Carolina. Today, there's fewer than 50,000. So, and the kind of farms, you know, and today there's small businesses with computers and everything. Back then, there were, you know, they were often tenant farms or small struggling farmers. So the nature of farming changed and the state became wealthier. And so as the state became wealthier, it was a pretty poor state in mid 20th century. As it moved into later years, the income was rising and people felt less need for government. Other factors too, but those are several.
In the brief time that we have left, then the third generation, Meg Scott Phipps, gets elected to be the agriculture commissioner, but had a fall from grace because of some electoral related things.
So Meg Scott Phipps got elected agriculture commissioner in the year 2000, and she ended up going to prison for campaign finance irregularities. And the basic problem there was she hadn't got the message that you know, when her father and her grandfather coming along, there were a few campaign laws on the books. So these were the ages of the brown paper bag and cash being changed hands and a lot of self-serving stuff going on. And they really she hadn't really been understood that these changes had taken place.
Well, there's a lot more to learn in this book. It is titled The Rise and Fall of the Branch Head Boys. Its author is Rob Christensen. Thanks so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. In 2004, the Robeson County Sheriff's Office was removed from a federal program called Equitable Sharing. That following the discovery of corruption in the sheriff's office that eventually led to several criminal convictions on a variety of charges. But in late November, the U.S. Department of Justice announced that the Robeson Sheriff's Office had been reinstated to the federal Equitable Sharing Program. That news is concerning, according to our next guest. He is John Guzet, Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation, a frequent guest here on Carolina Journal Radio. John, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
What is equitable sharing?
This is a program that the federal government launched in the 1980s. Under it, state and local law enforcement agencies can take advantage of federal equitable sharing, federal asset forfeiture laws that allow property to be taken without charging or convicting the owner of the property with a crime. If there's cause to believe that that property was used for or derived from a crime, then under federal drug laws and some other federal laws, that property can be taken, sold, and the proceeds returned to the law enforcement agency that made the seizure. The reason this is appealing to state and law, local law enforcement agencies, and the reason it's a concern to us is because this makes it possible for state law enforcement agencies to circumvent protections that exist under state law. North Carolina has very good state laws regarding asset forfeiture. And under our laws, before you can take that property, you have to prove that it was actually used for the crime, and you have to prove that it was, and you have to convict the owner of that crime. Not only that, but under our laws, the proceeds have to be used for public education. They can't go back to the law enforcement agency that made the seizure. None of that's true under federal law, and that's why we say that the equitable sharing makes it possible for state and local agencies to circumvent our state laws.
John, does that mean then that federal law trumps, and no pun intended, trumps state law?
Well, yes, it does. I mean, federal law does trump state law in the first place, at least in many cases. And in this case, it just makes state law irrelevant because they're operating under federal law, even though the agency itself is an organ of state government, they're able to use federal law rather than state law to process the takings.
It's curious to me why at the state level it would be deemed to be something that we should protect our citizens from. But at the federal level, there's clearly a very different point of view. Help us understand what's the difference in the two rationales.
Well, I think the difference is that we have a history of being sensible in North Carolina, and we have a history of protecting our citizens in a way that many other states haven't done and that the federal government certainly doesn't do. I think it's a testimony to the wisdom of our legislature. And it's also kind of a condemnation of Congress and federal agencies.
How lucrative is this to our sheriff's office or another agency that participates in North Carolina? And in a moment, we'll talk a little bit more about how pervasive this is.
Well, it can be quite lucrative. Overall, for instance, we found that in 2018, state and local agencies in North Carolina collected over $17 million through the program. As a percentage of their total budgets, that's probably not that high, but it varies a lot from one agency to another. And even though $17 million is still a lot of money, and it provides an incentive, and this is what we worry about most of all, provides an incentive to use equitable sharing, not to punish criminals, but to enrich law enforcement agencies.
And that's very concerning. And certainly, we're not trying to be anti-law enforcement here, anything like that in this discussion. It's just that it does build in an incentive to perhaps look at a case outside of the actual facts and issues of public safety.
That's right. There's a lot of reasons to not like civil asset forfeiture, which is what this program does. The fact that it exposes people to risks even if they haven't committed a crime. The fact that it denies them due process when the property is taken. But in my mind, the biggest reason to be unhappy about civil asset forfeiture and to be glad we don't have it under state law and to worry about the fact that the feds have made it available through the equitable sharing program is that it does tend to corrupt law enforcement agencies. We don't want that to happen in North Carolina. Other states, Texas in particular, but many other states that have had their own civil asset forfeiture laws have seen some terrible abuse, real predatory policing or policing for profit. That hasn't happened so much here because our state laws protect the innocent. We don't want it to happen here. So that's why it's a shame that this equitable sharing goes on, and we wish we could put a stop to it.
John, our listeners might be thinking, well, that's all really interesting, but it sounds kind of academic and very technical. Do we have examples of how this has actually played out and impacted the lives of very real people?
Well, we certainly do. In fact, in some of the research we've published on this topic, we list some specific examples. A lady in Durham, for instance, whose house was taken because her son was accused of or suspected of dealing drugs from inside the house. He may or may not have been guilty because he was never charged, but her house was taken and it took her. She had to spend a lot of money. She eventually did get it back, thanks to the efforts of a very good lawyer, but shouldn't have happened in the first place. More importantly, we also have evidence that it's corrupting. I mean, what happened in Robeson County is an example. Presumably, they were abusing this power or they wouldn't have lost it. It's, I suppose, good that they've cleaned up their act and they're getting the power back. But this is a power that puts temptation in the way of otherwise honest police departments, and we don't want that.
At the federal level, it's rather interesting. You've been writing about the history of this at the federal level, and curious that some administrations view equitable sharing and asset forfeiture one way, and a different presidential administration can view it very differently. We've had that example recently.
Well, it's true that during the Obama years, they did cut back on equitable sharing, which was good, but they didn't eliminate it. It is also true that once Jeff Sessions became the attorney general, he reinstituted it in full, and he likes it, and presumably Donald Trump likes it too. But I don't think there's ever been a presidential election since this program started in the 80s that has been skeptical of it or not wanted to do it, they like it. And it's going to go on until it's up to the states really to take measures to protect their own citizens by passing laws that prevent their law enforcement agencies from participating.
So, John, moving forward here at the state level in North Carolina, is there anything that you would recommend that lawmakers do in order to ensure that the protections are in place here?
There absolutely is. I think that our legislature ought to pass laws, anti-circumvention laws, and we've made some specific suggestions about the content of those laws that provide real limits on under what circumstances state law enforcement agencies can do this, and in some cases ban it altogether.
Is there an appetite in the legislature to do something like this?
Well, I'm not sure I go that far, but there's been some interest, and we hope that with the right kind of education and more information, they'll eventually will have the appetite and get it done.
It's a really fascinating subject, a public policy, civil asset forfeiture, and the different implications of this and how it actually takes place in North Carolina, the different agencies that do get revenue by working with the federal government. John Guzet has detailed all of that in His writings on this, available at johnlock.org. John, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.